This is one of those times of the year when you see a few additional items in the grocery store. Yeah, the extra eggs and all the chocolate bunnies for Easter, but also the gefilte fish and matzahs and other items for the Passover table. Today's guest is very familiar with those and expands the zone a lot in her book, Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen. Yes, we'll talk about gefilte fish and matzah in its various forms, but there's a whole lot more to the subject matter. Leah Koenig is our guest. She makes a living writing about food. Her work appears in many of the major food publications and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, among others. And she's the author of an earlier book, The Hadassah Everyday Cookbook. Leah Koenig, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this book and how it differs from the previous one.
Sure. Well, this book is really what I see as part of a larger conversation that is going on around Jewish food right now. I think, you know, throughout history, people have sort of, throughout American history, I should say, people have really thought of Jewish food as being sort of an old world thing and having a lot of nostalgic value, but not necessarily a lot of relevance for the contemporary table. And so, you know, this book is really trying to kind of flip the script a little bit and kind of embrace traditional Jewish cuisine and to do it in a way that is really relevant to today's kitchen.
So does the script need flipping in part because there's a bit of a rap on Jewish cooking? Is it sort of like English cooking of a decade ago where people sort of assume some rather dull things about it?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people sort of assume, you know, they hear brisket and potato pancakes and kugel and they sort of kind of sigh and say, oh, you know, I have memories of my mom's kugel being hard as a rock or the matzo balls are being, you know, kind of these little hockey pucks. And, you know, I think there's a, you know, a new generation of people, whether it's the folks, you know, at Kenny and Zook's in Portland or, you know, Mile End Deli here in where I live in Brooklyn, that are really saying, no, like these foods are actually, when they're done well, they're actually really delicious and, you know, have relevance outside of just the Jewish community as being just really delicious foods. And on top of that, you're also seeing people sort of embracing other parts of Jewish cuisine. So, you know, Jews have lived pretty much everywhere in the world throughout history, and as far-flung places as China and India and Ethiopia, there have been Jewish communities. So you're really talking about a global cuisine that has much more to offer than just the five or six, you know, foods that everybody kind of knows.
Well, it should be global, but as you point out, a lot of the emphasis up till now seems to be a lot on Eastern European Jewish cuisine.
That's right. And, you know, that's because the majority of people who came to America, you know, in the kind of 1880s through 1920s were Eastern European background. And that's my background as well. So I think a lot of people are most familiar with that. But, you know, there's Middle Eastern Jewish cuisines and there's Spanish Jewish cuisines. And, you know, those are much more vegetable forward and much more focused on olive oil and, you know, just kind of foods that maybe mesh a little bit more with how we eat now. So if you're talking about the Jewish palate taken as a whole, it's, you know, it's a very vibrant and very exciting cuisine to explore.
You give us the quick differences in the book too, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, and Mizrahi Jews. Can you explain those again?
Sure. So Ashkenazi cuisine, or, you know, that's basically the Eastern European, the briskets, the kugels, the matzah balls. Sephardic cuisine is, you know, this is obviously a very broad stroke, but it's food that kind of developed in the Iberian Peninsula, so in, you know, basically in Spain, Portugal, and that has, you know, spread throughout other parts of the world as Jews have moved, but, you know, so that is a much more Mediterranean cuisine. And then there's also a Mizrahi cuisine, which is, you know, the Jews who live in, you know, the Middle East and North Africa. So, you know, Jews from Morocco, Jews from Iraq, Jews from Iran, places like that. And so that cuisine is very similar to what you would think of with Arabic cuisine.
Okay, and from Israel, from modern-day Israel, too, I would think.
Right. So most of the Jews who are from those places now live in Israel, and so you that's a real melting pot of all of those cuisines.
Now, I noticed, Leah, from the foreword that you have worked as a research chef. That sounds exciting. Tell us about that work.
You know, well, I do a lot of research for magazines, and that's, you know, it's always fun because I get to you know, kind of delve into subjects at a deeper level. But what I really love to do is cook in people's homes. And one of my favorite examples is there's a recipe for an Ethiopian stew called dorowat in the book. And, you know, dorowat is just, a delicious chicken stew with eggs in it, hard-boiled eggs that get kind of cooked in the shell in the stew. And it's popular throughout Ethiopia, but Ethiopian Jews use it for a Sabbath dish. And have adapted it to, you know, the kosher laws, and have really kind of made it their own for the Sabbath. And I had the opportunity to cook in the kitchen with a woman named Biji Barhani, who is an Ethiopian Jew, whose family now lives in Israel, but she lives in New York City. And so she taught me how to make this dish, and it was something that I had never personally tasted, and certainly was not part of my, you know, Jewish repertoire growing up. But it felt so familiar because she was, you know, cooking it and making it for, you know, for a Shabbat dinner. So that's the kind of thing that I really love to do, and kind of, you know, research the stories behind the food. And, you know, I've tried to put as much of that as possible into modern Jewish cooking.
So is this the chicken stew that comes after the classic chicken soup in the book?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to have a classic chicken soup.
No.
and, you know, I did want the book to speak to people who maybe are coming to these foods for the first time, either as a taster or, you know, probably more likely as a cook. So maybe they've grown up eating them, but they don't know how to make a classic chicken soup. And so I wanted there to be a few kind of very basic, you know, basic challah, basic chicken soup, basic latkes, so you could kind of see it as a reference as well as a jumping off point.
So it starts at what a lot of people would know Jewish food to be, and then expands the zone quite a bit from there. Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen. Leah Koenig is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more and get into the recipes in some depth here. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or email if you'd like to get into part of the conversation. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Koenig and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the cook and author Leah Koenig. She's the author of the book Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen, a chance to really expand the zone from what might be some longstanding views of Jewish cookery and get into some fairly fun and wild stuff here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So unlike some of the people we talked to who, you know, did their first easy bake oven thing at like age 6, it sounds like you came to cooking a bit later in life, Leah.
I did. You know, my mother was a fantastic cook. But when I was a kid, I just, you know, I danced and I was, you know, active in all these other things. And I just never really, I kind of took it for granted, and I never really took the opportunity to learn from her. So it wasn't until college that I really first kind of discovered the pleasures of the stove. And, you know, when I did, you know, I started to make things that were, you know, very kind of typical of a college kid in America. So, you know, stir fries and a lot of tofu and things like that. But then the Jewish holidays began to roll around, and I realized that I really wanted to have you know, a repertoire of Jewish foods, and that for me was very much a kind of jumping off point for getting interested in Jewish cuisine.
And on one hand, you lament not knowing your grandmother, some of her wonderful recipes, but on the other hand, you say that gives you freedom. In what sense?
Yeah, well, you know, if I could have had anything, I would have loved to have had the chance to cook with my grandma Bessie, but you know, she passed away before I was born, so you know, I missed out on that as well. But as I was kind of, you know, learning some of the classics and developing them, I realized that I didn't have sort of the shackles, I guess, of tradition kind of weighing down on me that said, you know, well, your grandma did it this way, so you have to do it this way. There was a certain amount of freedom and a certain amount of just creativity that I could embrace, I think, because I didn't necessarily have things handed down to me.
Keeping kosher, do you do that now? Did you do it back in your college days?
You know, I didn't grow up keeping kosher. My dad is actually not Jewish, and you know, our family was Jewish, but we didn't keep kosher. And in college, I was, you know, for 10 years I was a vegetarian, so I sort of kept kosher because I didn't actually break any of the laws, but I didn't technically keep kosher. But now, you know, my husband is actually from an Orthodox background, and we keep a kosher kitchen at home so that, you know, we can entertain family and, you know, make sure that our guests who do keep a very strict kosher diet feel comfortable in our house. So, yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle right now, but I'm definitely very familiar with the kosher laws and, you know, respect them very much.
So it doesn't create any particular issues for making recipes or anything like that. I mean, obviously you wouldn't put them in the book if you didn't, you know, there are no issues with trying to obtain ingredients that are kosher, that sort of thing.
No. Yeah. You know what I do? I actually say in the book that it's a kosher book, but it's not. It's kosher and that all of the recipes are, don't break any of the kosher laws and would be completely usable and user-friendly for anybody who does keep kosher. But, you know, I purposefully didn't want to put the word kosher on the cover because for me, Jewish cuisine is so much more, I am so much more interested in the culture and the history behind it. And I think of the kosher laws as a part of that, but not the whole story. So for me, it's really important that, you know, people who don't keep kosher, people who aren't even Jewish or might be not Jewish and marrying into a Jewish family and want to learn some of these dishes, I really wanted the book to be accessible to everybody. So that is where I went with that.
The book is called Modern Jewish Cooking. Leah Koenig wrote it. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. There's a section about stocking and equipping the kitchen, which we always appreciate because it gives us an idea of the stuff we'll need. Now, two things do stand out here, though, and one is measuring dry ingredients. Mm. And a couple of techniques there that you say really do make a difference.
Yeah, you know, everyone in this country basically uses the scoop method. So you have your measuring cups, and you dip them into your flour and you level them off. And, you know, that really yields a very inconsistent, you know, amount of flour. And, you know, that can be fine for lots of recipes. But especially for baking, you know, I think there's kind of beginning to be a movement in this country towards using a scale to measure the weight of your flour and your other dried ingredients. It's a slow movement, but you're starting to see it, especially amongst bakers. And, you know, when you're making something like the chocolate raspberry babka in the book or challah or, you know, anything, the hamantaschen dough, I think really using the scale, which are super cheap, you can get them at, you know, Target or wherever for not that much money, can really kind of give you more consistency with your baked goods.
And I've talked to a bunch of bakers over the years who really, really advocate that. The other thing that stood out from the equipping the kitchen thing was storing spices, and I think you busted our kitchen here.
I really think that storing spices, having good spices is key to having good food, and your spices can get old really, really fast if you keep them by a heat source. So unfortunately, having them right above your stovetop is actually not the best place to store your spices. You want them in a cooler, dark cabinet if possible. And you want to give them the sniff test and kind of make sure they still smell vibrant because obviously how they smell is very much going to impact how they taste in your food. And when you're talking about Jewish cuisine, especially the more Mediterranean and Middle Eastern Jewish cuisines, spices play a huge part. So it's important to kind of keep your spice cabinet up to date.
Right, not musty. If you open the jar and don't smell anything, it's not a good sign, right?
Exactly.
Before we go meal by meal, as the book does, you start with breakfast. Is there one dish that's really the star player of this book?
Oh, goodness. You know, it's like asking your favorite child.
Right. Which is?
I think I have favorites kind of scattered throughout the book, and one of the fun things has been having people tell me what they've been making and me saying, oh, that's one of my favorite recipes. But I think one of my favorites is actually the French toast in the first chapter. There's a savory French toast that kind of bucks the trend that French toast has to be sweet and drenched in maple syrup, as delicious as that is. So it takes challah bread or sourdough, which are both sort of classic Jewish breads that you either find on the Shabbat table or in a delicatessen, and, you know, batters them and fries them in the normal way, but instead of putting on maple syrup, I made a compound butter, which is just, you soften butter and add za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern herb that's very fragrant and very lemony, and I add extra lemon zest and cracked pepper, and you kind of use that as your topping. And then I also sear some tomatoes so they kind of are falling apart and super juicy and tender. And, you know, that is just a really, to me, really fun dish that kind of brings together the Eastern European and the Sephardic, and is really just kind of fun and unexpected.
I'm glad you brought that one up, because I must admit I was hearing the sound of breaks when I saw that page. It's like, wait a minute, savory French toast? But there it is, and it does sound very good. And I should give credit to the photographer here, too. Who's your photographer? Because you did a wonderful job.
Yeah, his name is Sang An, and he is so great. And the whole team that did the book, the styling and the food photography just did a fantastic job.
Okay, as long as we're still on breakfast with a savory French toast, you start with granola, which I've always wondered about making my own. What are some of the basic rules here?
Sure. Well, the basic rules are, one of my kind of go-to rules is don't add your dried fruit when you're cooking it or when you're baking it, because it can burn really easily. So, you know, you want to toast the oats and the nuts and the spices and all of that, and then add the fruit at the end. But since Passover is actually about to arrive, I kind of want to give a shout-out to one of the recipes in the book, which is a matzah granola, which may be another, you know, record-scratching recipe. But it all it does is it replaces the rolled oats with crumbled-up matzah, and it has coconut and walnuts and raisins, and I think it's sweetened with maple syrup, if I remember correctly. And it's just a really nice thing to have on hand during Passover, when, you know, breakfast can actually be such a challenge because you can't have flour and you can't have pancakes and you can't have bread. And there's, you know, so it's really nice to have something kind of sweet and crunchy and delicious over yogurt for breakfast.
Leah Koenig is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen. The book looks good enough to eat by itself, but there's a lot of good stuff in here. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have some questions or comments. 800-838-3760 throughout our listening area. 800-838-3760. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. And just in time for Passover, can we get a refresher course in matzah and braai and balls and all the other iterations of it?
Well, matzah is one of those sort of wonder foods. You know, a lot of people kind of groan when they think about matzah and say, oh, I wouldn't eat matzah any second longer than I have to. But, you know, it's a pretty fun thing to work with during the holiday. And matzah braai is one of my, you know, another actually on the dessert, or sorry, the breakfast chapter is one of my favorites. It's basically the French toast of Passover. So you crumble it up and you kind of soften it a little bit in egg, and you fry it in butter. And, you know, traditionally you'd kind of eat it either savory with a little bit of salt or sweet with cinnamon and sugar. But in the book, I offer two different ways to serve matzah braai. One is with roasted strawberries that is just lovely and springy, and, you know, roasting the fruit really kind of brings out its sweetness. Or with sautéed leeks and mushrooms and a sprinkle of Parmesan. And that's kind of a fun brunch dish during Passover. You know, and one thing that people, I think, forget about Passover is that there's a lot you can still eat. You know, people kind of focus on the restrictions and the prohibitions, but there's a lot of fun you can still have with the ingredients.
You do talk about Passover monotony in here. So what are the things that you are proscribed from eating?
Well, so traditionally you're not allowed to really eat anything leavened that is made with either wheat, spelt, oats, barley, or rye. Those are the kind of five grains you stay away from, and that, you know, that's a lot. And then, you know, if you are of Eastern European background, there's further restrictions of, you know, corn and legumes and peanuts and things that kind of could potentially be mistaken as one of those other ingredients. So it's a lot, but, you know, you still have the whole fruit and vegetable kingdom. Basically, you have meat, you have dairy, you have eggs. So there's a lot still to work with.
I don't see rice on there, so rice flour, that sort of thing, is okay?
Mm, No, actually, rice is, not rice is not okay. if you're of Eastern European background, some Sephardic Jews have different interpretations of the law, and so they do eat rice. So if you're lucky enough to be either born or married into one of those families, you have a much easier time. But one of the wonderful things that's happened in recent years is quinoa has been kind of widely approved for Passover. It turns out it's actually a seed and not a grain. So it has been kind of this sort of wonder, miracle food for Passover over the last couple of years.
And I ask this question of just about every chef who talks about quinoa. How do you get it to not have that brassy kind of bitter taste?
Yeah, you know, rinse it well. Always salt your water a little bit. And, you know, with quinoa, you really want to kind of focus on having a good dressing or a good, vinaigrette or lots of fresh herbs or things that will sort of complement its flavor well. But, you know, it is a problem, and really rinsing it is one of the best things you can do.
Okay. Before we get out of the breakfast chapter, I want to ask about the sixth item is a coffee cake, which just makes your mouth water. And you say we don't see these very much anymore. Is it just because of health concerns?
Yeah. You know, I talk a lot about my great-grandma, Lillian, who, you know, she just was one of those cooks who, didn't care about fat and didn't care about all of that because you didn't know to. You just kind of knew what tasted good and what made you feel good when you ate it. And so my coffee cake is, you know, definitely not one of the healthiest recipes in the book. It has sour cream. It has, a lot of butter and sugar. But I really feel like, don't make those foods all the time, but they should be a part of the repertoire because, they are so good and they are so comforting. I think coffee cake has kind of gone the way of the dinosaur a little bit because of health concerns. But, I would encourage people to enjoy it in moderation.
Did you do much adjusting in modern Jewish cooking for health concerns, drop the fat in some of the recipes, that sort of thing?
I didn't specifically. It's not a diet book or anything like that. But, my approach to kind of healthy eating is to really have a vegetable-forward diet, so to really focus a lot on fresh salads and, whole grains and, lean proteins, and to kind of make those the center of your diet and then to punctuate it with, this occasional sweet treat or things that are a little bit, heavier, fried food. I kind of find that taking the full approach, unless you're on a specific diet for a specific health reason, it's better or it's best to sort of take an approach that's kind of holistic and enjoy everything in moderation.
Okay, and speaking of vegetables forward, then that gets us into the chapter on salads and spreads, which starts with a spring pea salad with browned butter vinaigrette. Let's talk about the first time making that, because the thing that's always concerned me about working with butter when you get it too hot is to not get it to where it burns.
Yeah, you got to watch butter as you cook it. Brown butter is one of the easiest and hardest things to make. You just kind of have to catch it right as the when you're cooking it, the white solids will kind of rise to the top, and you kind of want to skim them off and then take it off the heat, because if those solids sink to the bottom, they start to burn, and then you get that kind of acrid smell, which you obviously don't want. So work over a lowish heat and swirl your pan and just kind of keep an eye on it.
Speaking of pans, I didn't get into that part in the equipment section. I mean, how do you feel about the nonstick cookware, any of the modern conveniences there, et cetera? What do you tend to cook in?
Sure. I have a very small kitchen in Brooklyn where I live. And, I always joke that if people saw my kitchen, they would question my right to be a food writer and cookbook author. I really think that you can be a fantastic cook with just about any equipment, with one exception, which is knives. I think you have to have a good set of knives, because when you're trying to hack away at a squash and it's not opening and it's you're, God forbid, cutting your finger, like, it's probably the knife that's the problem. So I don't think you have to have the fanciest of everything, but you do want to get yourself a good set of knives.
Yeah, many my tomato has died a horrible death in my kitchen because I hadn't had a chance to sharpen the knives.
Totally.
So I hear you on not cooking on hot days, which can be especially hot and sticky in greater New York. This is an Israeli watermelon salad in here that involves some cooking. Tell us about that recipe.
Yeah, so Israeli salad is a really lovely dish, and there's iterations of it found throughout the Middle East. It's basically chopped tomatoes, cucumbers, red onion, and then a bunch of herbs like parsley. You could do some dill if you wanted, but really it's a very fresh salad, and sometimes it has feta in it also. And more recently, in the last 5 or 10 years, you're starting to see watermelon and feta salad become more popular on people's tables. And so my hope was to kind of bring those two salads together, and it turns out that the sweet and crisp nature of a watermelon goes really, really well with kind of the juicy acidity of a tomato. So I put them together and made this very refreshing watermelon Israeli salad that's, really a delightful thing to have in the summer.
Is the watermelon the cooked part? Is that what gets warmed there too?
No, it's actually an all-fresh salad. The cooking is you toast some pepitas, some pumpkin seeds, and that kind of brings out their oils, and you have the kind of this sprinkling of crunchy, nutty pumpkin seeds on the top.
Okay, a lot more recipes to talk about in modern Jewish cooking. We have a few minutes more with Leah Koenig on the opposite side of the break. You can join us then at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about modern Jewish cooking with Leah and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Leah Koenig, cook and author. She's written a book called Modern Jewish Cooking, Recipes and Customs for Today's Kitchen. We get her just before Passover begins tomorrow evening. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join Leah as we discuss some of the recipes in the book, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So back into the chapter on salads and spreads, making your own hummus. How involved a process is this, Leah?
It is actually not that difficult. And my version starts with canned chickpeas, which, some people would say it's always better to use fresh chickpeas and to soak them. But, when you're talking about, a realistic kind of modern kitchen, sometimes you don't have time for that. So, it's really not that hard. It's a whir in the food processor. And then, my trick is to kind of strain it through a fine mesh sieve at the end to get it ultra kind of silky and smooth, and it's good fun to do.
What are you adding in as you're whirling up the chickpeas?
Pardon, say that again.
What kinds of things do you add in along with the chickpeas?
Oh, sure. You add lemon juice and garlic. You can add spices. You can add a bunch of fresh parsley if you wanted to kind of give it a springy flavor. And what I like to do is actually make something called hummus im basar, which is a Middle Eastern dish that you saute up some lamb with spices and pine nuts and kind of put that over top of the hummus when you're done. And it's basically a meal, a meal in a dish.
There's a good pear salad in here, which is going to prove popular in our region because you're talking the home of Harry and David just a few miles away from our studio and all the pear trees around here. Walk us through what's in this grilled pear salad.
Sure. The grilled pear salad is really, again, one of my favorite dishes. I think we're seeing a lot of fruit in salads lately, but I really like the idea of having a kind of a cooked fruit. And when you grill a pear, it becomes very smoky and very soft and very sweet. So I pair that with, you're going to have to actually remind me because it's been a while since I've made that dish, but I believe there's walnuts in there and a vinaigrette, and it really just kind of is a very good autumnal salad.
Okay, sounds good. We have a call here from Jerry in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about modern Jewish cooking with Leah Koenig.
Well, good morning. I found years ago a great way to deal with quinoa because my friends complained of the bitterness. if you, I buy it at the co-op in bulk, and then I take it home and wash it and wash it and wash it. I mean, really wash it. Then you take it when it's wet and put it into a large, dry frying pan, about a cup at a time, and you heat it until it's toasted. Then you cool it, put it in a sealed plastic bag, and put it in the refrigerator. And it's delicious because it's toasted and not bitter.
Mm, so it really gets a nutty flavor, it sounds like, from the toasting.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah,
oh,
sounds great.
That is good to know, Jerry. Thanks for joining us on that one. You mentioned already, too, about using canned chickpeas. So it sounds like given a choice between something dried and something that's already prepared, but particularly where beans come in, you're going to go for the canned stuff?
You know, it really depends on the situation. And, you know, for people who are kind of, diehard, soak and cook their own beans, especially if you have a pressure cooker and it's not that hard, I say definitely go for it. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis for myself, like if I'm coming home and I want to get dinner on the table, I find that for many situations, canned beans work just fine.
There's a recipe for a slaw with caramelized walnuts in here, and I'm sure everybody's going to pronounce it caramelized as well. what is that process? How do you caramelize or caramelize anything?
Sure. Well, that slaw, it's a beet and red cabbage slaw. It's one of my favorite things as well. See, you got me doing it. You got me saying my favorites. it's basically like borscht in a bowl. So it's, it's got that flavor of the sweet beets and the crunchiness from the cabbage. And on top of it, you are adding these walnuts that have been caramelized with balsamic vinegar and brown sugar. And, you know, caramelizing a nut is really not that difficult. Often you do it with sugar and a little butter. And in this case, I replaced the butter for balsamic vinegar so that it is, you know, a little bit healthier. And it just adds this like extra layer of crunch and flavor to the dish that I think is really kind of worth the extra 5 minutes.
There's a recipe in here for chopped chicken liver, which, as you point out, is a Jewish staple. Is there a new twist you put on it yourself?
Yeah. So, you know, I happen to love chopped liver. It's one of the kind of old world foods that I think really just kind of stands the test of time. But so I offer two different versions of it. One is a traditional chopped liver with hard-boiled egg chopped in, but I add pomegranate molasses, which is kind of a tangy concentrate of pomegranate juice that's very popular throughout Israel and the Middle East. And I also add a little bit of cayenne pepper to give it a little kick. So those are my twists. And then I also offer a vegetarian version made with green beans and walnuts and a hard-boiled egg. And, you know, people kind of laugh at the thought of a vegetarian chopped chicken liver, but it's actually something that the old, dairy restaurants in New York City, like Ratner's or, you know, other places, it was actually a menu item even back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So it has its own little history of being a Jewish cuisine item.
The pomegranate molasses you mentioned for the real chicken liver, it actually has chicken liver in it. How hard is that to find, particularly for folks who live in not big cities?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely not, you know, something that you can pop down to an average grocery store and find. You can find it more and more at health food stores, and, you know, if you live in a place with a Middle Eastern population, you can definitely find it. But what I do is at the very back of the book, I have a pantry section that lists all of the harder-to-find ingredients and sources to find it online. So, you know, luckily we live in an age where everything is pretty much at your fingertips on the internet. So
UPS brings it 2 days later, yes.
Yeah, and if you buy a bottle, it lasts you for a nice long time. So it's kind of worth the investment.
Now, the chapter on soups, there's a sourdough gazpacho in here. I love gazpacho, but usually when the weather gets that hot that I want to eat gazpacho, I have no energy to want to make it. How difficult is it?
You know, one of the nice things about gazpacho, which, you know, the traditional Spanish soup, is that it's just kind of a chop and blend soup. It's not that hard to make, and is very, very refreshing. And, you know, this version kind of goes with the traditional method of adding a little bit of bread to give the soup flavor and richness. And so I use sourdough, which is, you know, a classic delicatessen bread, to kind of give it a little bit of extra body.
There's an aside in here, Leah, on Jewish farming, and you say that Jewish farm seems like a punchline to a bad joke. Is there a modern trend to get Jewish people back to the land or something?
Yeah, you know, traditionally, if you're going back thousands of years, the Jews were originally an agricultural people. You know, they tended and tilled the land, and a lot of the kind of Jewish texts have a lot to say about agriculture and farming and how to do it well and right, which is a surprise to a lot of people. And, you know, in different parts throughout history, Jews have kind of embraced those agricultural roots and gone back to farming. And you're seeing a little bit of that today with the modern kind of food movement of people being really interested in sustainable cooking and ingredients. You're starting to see various programs for, you know, especially young Jewish farmers to kind of intentionally kind of go back to the land and farm from a Jewish, you know, kind of Jewish perspective.
Mm-hmm. And then the locally sourced food movement and then the farm to fork, all that stuff. Which raises the question then about whether there are in restaurants and kitchens the idea of some sort of Jewish fusion. Are you getting fusions between the kind of cuisine you have in this book and other traditions?
Oh, definitely. You know, here in New York, you're seeing things like pastrami egg rolls, and you're starting to see, you know, everything bagel, the spices on it. You're starting to see everything bagel spiced X, Y, and Z, like just anything under the sun. You're starting to see pastrami rubbed salmon with the pastrami spices. So, you know, you really are starting to see it. And I think that just the way that, you know, ramen has become very popular and, you know, Korean food, people are starting to kind of re-look at it and embrace it in new ways, that Jewish food has a lot to kind of offer and share with the wider food community. So it's been a really exciting thing to see.
And you have done some exploring yourself, not just in recipes, but also in other parts of the world. And it's interesting to read about the part where you got one of your best Shabbat dinners in Rome.
Yeah. So when my husband and I were on our honeymoon in Rome, we ended up sort of through a friend of a friend having a fantastic Shabbat dinner at the kind of premier kosher caterer of Rome. And he just, you know, was so gracious and so welcoming. And his table was just kind of filled with all these fantastic meat dishes and, you know, traditional Roman Jewish foods. And, you know, one of my very favorites from that night was a dish called stracotto, which is, I'm probably saying wrong, but was basically the Italian Jewish version of brisket. And it was, you know, it's cooked forever in red wine until it's basically falling apart. And, you know, I based the brisket in my book off of the one I had there. And it was just, it was a phenomenal meal.
Which part of the animal is the brisket? I've never quite figured that one out.
You know, I don't actually know a huge amount about where it comes from.
We'll skip the anatomy lesson.
Yeah, you know, my friends Naf and Anna run a company called Grow and Behold, which is a sustainable kosher meat company, and they'd be the ones to ask. But I do know that there's two parts of it. There's the first cut and the second cut, and they are very different in texture.
Were they the friends who brought you back to meat after you'd been a vegetarian for a time?
You know, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and give them that credit. Yeah, they were.
Fair enough. So onto the chapter on vegetables, there's the turnip recipe in here makes me ask if bad cooks give veggies bad raps.
Yeah, you know, I think we're really seeing across the board kind of a embracing of vegetables that has a lot to do with realizing we've just been cooking them in a way that doesn't bring out their best flavor for a long time. So, you know, if you boil something to death, it's going to taste like it's been boiled to death. But if you either roast it or, in the case of the turnips, you know, kind of pan roast them in butter, they're just delicious. And you can kind of rediscover a whole new category of food that you maybe wrote off before.
Colleen snuck off to Wikipedia to show me what the cut of brisket is. It's
from the
breast or lower chest of beef or veal. And there's a lot of connective tissue in there, so you have to cook it correctly to tenderize that and don't make it all stringy and tough.
Right, and that's actually the other reason. Thank you, Colleen, for doing that. It's the other reason why you want to always cut brisket across the grain instead of with it, because if you cut it with the grain, you get all that stringiness of the connective tissue.
Okay, I have to get to some traditional Jewish items in here before we go. Latkes,
sure.
Which I've done, and I made the mistake of trying to leave the eggs out. That's kind of a basic step, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, eggs do really help to bind latkes, and I went very, very traditional with my latkes because my mom, when I was growing up, she always made the absolute best kind of crispy on the outside and tender on the inside latkes. So I use her recipe, and the way I sort of jazz it up is instead of making applesauce, I make an apple date chutney with a lot of spices that's kind of reminiscent of Indian cuisine. And my sour cream, I add cinnamon and a little maple syrup too. So it's kind of a way of having a very traditional and familiar latke topped with, dressed up for the occasion, I guess.
Kugel, you mentioned right at the outset. It's one of my wife's dishes. What's in it?
Mm-hmm. Well, kugel is a very wide category of casserole-y type foods. Some of the most popular versions are either a potato kugel, which is, potato and onion and a lot of egg and a little oil bound together. You can also do a noodle kugel, which is, often egg noodles mixed with, sour cream or cottage cheese, and you can be sweetened or not. And they're really just kind of hearty side dishes that are some of my favorite parts of Jewish cuisine.
Some real comfort food.
Yeah, not necessarily the most heart healthy.
Got that point. It does seem like Alfredo in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's some similarities there. Yeah.
Gefilte fish, we haven't really talked about it at length yet. A lot of people just wonder what it is. I got to know it from living on Long Island myself. So always around at Passover season. What is it, and do some people just hate it?
Yeah, gefilte fish is a very divisive food, and often it's because, people are getting the jarred version, which is kind of floating in this very, murky, gelatinous liquid. It's just not so appetizing. But, traditionally it is a dish of finely chopped fish, that used to be stuffed back into the fish, and the fish would get sewn up and cooked that way, kind of like the way you thread up a turkey at Thanksgiving. And the word gefilte actually means stuffed in Yiddish. But along the way, the skin part kind of got lost, and people started making these fish quenelles or like fish balls and poaching them in fish stock. It's a very pungent dish, and the way that I kind of update it is instead of cooking them in fish broth, I cook them in a court bouillon, which is like a white wine and herb broth. It kind of lightens up the flavor quite a bit.
The updating's a lot of fun. The recipes all look really good, and the pictures really add a lot to that. The book is called Modern Jewish Cooking. Leah Koenig wrote it. She's been our guest on The Exchange. Leah, thanks so much.
Thanks. It was great.
It's been fun. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects at our website, jeffexchange.org. Segments are produced by Charlotte Duren. At the controls today, our associate producer, Colleen Pike. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Join us next time, and please have a great day.